7. Well, good morning again, everybody. Dave Nemo with you. And as promised, we're going to talk about the history of the American flag with vexillologist Dave Martucci up in Washington, Maine. Dave, welcome to the program. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And I got to tell you very, very bluntly, straight out, I don't know that I knew what vexillology was until this week when Claire Marie told me that you were going to be on the program. It's just one of those words that escaped me.
Oh, yeah, it's a fairly new word. It was coined in the 1950s. And it has both Latin and Greek roots. And the vexillum, which is the main part of the word where it comes from, is a Roman word that was essentially the name of the first symbol that used cloth as an important part of its symbolism.
Okay, and back in, I guess, in those days, in the earliest days, it wouldn't have been a flag in terms of a rectangular or square piece of cloth on a pole. That would have been more of a banner, I guess, huh?
Well, originally, what we would term a vexilloid, a pre-flag-like symbol, was basically a stick with something on top of it.
Okay.
And that eventually evolved into our flagpole,
mm-hmm.
And the important symbolism eventually migrated to the flag on the pole rather than the thing at the top of the pole.
Your own personal webpage is vexman.net, has some fascinating stuff on there, and you have I just got lost in that 16-page series that you, good flag, bad flag kind of a thing about flag design, and I'm going to link that to our site with your permission today.
That'd be great.
And I think folks would really enjoy that. Well, Flag Day is Sunday, of course. It marks the anniversary of June 14, 1777, and the first recognized formal observance of Flag Day, I think, was up in Wisconsin with some school children, and we kind of went from there in terms of an observance. But Flag Day has never really become an official federal holiday, although I think a couple of states have an official Flag Day holiday.
Yeah, that's right. It's one of those minor holidays, as they consider it, although to me, of course, it's one of the major holidays of the year.
It is to us, too, as a matter of fact, Dave, and always has been. We've always done special programming on Flag Day in honor of the Stars and Stripes, and we start our program each day with the Star Spangled Banner. And I don't want to start with that because that Fort McHenry flag is a little unusual, but where do we go with our flag in terms of the first, do we say official or unofficial American flag?
Well, it was an interesting evolution. Before the Stars and Stripes, there was no concept of a national flag. Flags belonged to kings and to military units, and there were special flags for every usage. There was no single flag in any country. And it was the adoption of the Stars and Stripes, which was actually a very revolutionary act because it was adopted by the Congress, which was the representatives of the people, rather than imposed by a ruler, which has been the norm up to that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, we have taken that flag into our own selves and used it in ways that even to this day some other countries do not use it. In most countries, the national flag's embodied in their constitution and there's specific symbolism that it represents. We don't have that. Our flag was adopted by a resolution of Congress. It's not really ensconced into law as such. Technically, the people are free to interpret it any way they want, although the president now, since 1912, issues a specification sheet as to what it's supposed to look like. But technically, you know, this flag really belongs to us. It doesn't really belong to anybody else. I once did an essay on the flag for a radio advertisement that ran about a minute and a half for the Boeing Corporation. Not that I'm trying to give a plug to anybody, but and in it, I tried to distill the essence of what the flag is. And if anybody ever heard that was about 4 years ago. I think it really hit to the heart of the matter.
Do you remember it? I'd love to hear it.
I could give it to you right now.
Yeah, okay.
And here it is. Americans love their flag. It's perhaps the ultimate expression of what it means to be an American. Regardless of political philosophy or opinion, the flag represents us all, and at the same time, it transcends any attempt to define its symbolism. The Stars and Stripes was born on June 14, 1777, with a single tersely worded sentence, resolved that the flag of the United States be 13 stripes, alternate red and white, that the Union be 13 stars, white in a blue field, representing a new constellation. The entire meaning of the red, white, and blue was left freely to the imagination of the American people, with no specifications given for the exact pattern or dimension until President Taft standardized the design in 1912, nor has there ever been any government-ordained symbolism to believe in. Americans took the flag to heart immediately. We constantly renew its meaning and importance in our lives. It's the most changed flag in the world, having been officially amended 27 times. It is not a static thing. It's dynamic and alive. Ours was the first to be termed a national flag. Before it, only kings and governments and armies had flags. But Old Glory belongs to a people and not to a government. Even today, the British Union Jack technically belongs to the Crown. In addition to its obvious symbolism, that of 13 states grown to 50, yet one nation, Americans understand the flag in many different ways. Still, we believe in one flag and how it defines us all. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. For Americans, the flag is much more than a piece of cloth. We keep it in our hearts. It is a story of who we are, what we believe in, and where we are going. It's a story that has not yet been fully written.
Wow, that's a great, concise history and dissertation on the flag, Dave. Dave Martucci is with us. Dave is a vexillologist, past president of the North American Vexillological Association. I knew I'd stumble over that sooner or later. And that first designation of the flag, though, it basically didn't line it out very well, though, in terms of, well, gee, where do we put the stars and how do we line them up, or do we line them up?
It was a very different world in those days.
Yeah.
And you have to understand a couple things. First of all, this was a revolutionary act, and they really didn't have any idea what they were really doing. The second thing is that flags had slowly evolved out of a system called heraldry. And in heraldry is very different than vexillology in that the important part is what they call the blazon or the description. And a number of artists can interpret that in different ways as long as it meets the basic description. And that was true at this time with flags. You would have a basic description, but some of the details were open to interpretation. And as long as it met the basic criteria, 13 red and white stripes, a blue field, 13 white stars, that's all that was important.
The original stars, and of course there is some controversy and question about what Betsy Ross's actual place was and what did she do. Did she design the flag or did she sew the first flag? But in 1776, at least history tells us that Betsy Ross reports that she sewed the first American flag. But did she design the flag? Is she the mother of our flag, so to speak?
Well, Betsy herself nor her family have ever made the claim that she designed the flag, except that they claim that she was the one that introduced the five-pointed star.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, the design is credited in the story to George Washington, which is probably not true. One person who lived at the time made the claim at the time that he designed the flag, and nobody ever said he didn't, and that was Francis Hopkinson, who was a member of Congress from New Jersey. And he made claims at the time to having designed it, and he was in a position to have done so, and he was the chair of the Marine Committee that made the report on June 14th, 1777, that established the flag. So it's pretty likely he was the actual designer. As far as Betsy goes, we know that in 1776 and 1777, she made flags for the Pennsylvania Navy, and they had a similar but different design. The Navy of Pennsylvania flew a blue flag with a canton composed of 13 red and white stripes, and as far as we know, there were no stars on that flag. And we know she made flags for them. Whether she made stars and stripes, it's really kind of up in the air as to whether she did or not. It's likely she did. Did she make the first one? We will probably never know for sure.
When you say Canton, now if you picture the American flag, the blue field with the white stars up on the upper left-hand corner, that square, that is the Canton, correct?
Correct.
And then the rest of the flag, or the entire flag, if there was a background, that would be the field.
Right.
And then you would have the hoist side on the pole side and the fly side on the, well, the side that's kind of flapping in the breeze there.
That's right. Exactly right. We're the inheritors of the British system, and it's a fairly long-established custom to have what they term the union up in the corner and then a field. In British flags, the field's usually a solid color.
In fact, if you go back further than the actual, what we now call the Stars and Stripes, in the Canton, are the Grand Union flag, how does that play in? Because it had the British Union Jack up there in the Canton with the 13 red and white stripes.
Right.
Would that be considered the first quasi-American flag then?
Well, it was the first flag that represented an independent America. It was never officially adopted by Congress, but it was widely used by our Navy, and even George Washington had it hoisted in compliment to the United Colonies. It was, for all intents and purposes, our first flag, and it was actually a logical statement, because it took the British red ensign, which was very well known in the colonies, and divided the red field with white stripes to indicate the independence of the 13 states.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, the Sons of Liberty had long used a red and white striped flag, so it worked on a number of different levels.
One of the principles of flag design that you bring out in your work, Dave, is the fact that you want a flag to not just come out of nowhere. You want a flag that's going to be recognizable in terms of association. And I guess that would be the perfect example of it.
Right. Right. Yeah, all flags are related, and they're related to something either significant or related to other flags that relate to something significant. And one of the things that I did several years ago, which is not on my website, I probably ought to post it there one of these days, is I did what I called the genealogical chart of the American flag, in which I traced the roots of it to different flag designs that go all the way back to the Crusades.
Wow. Wow, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
You know what? We'll have to take the break here. We'll take the break, and when we come back, let's talk about the Star Spangled Banner, the one that inspired
sure.
Francis Scott Key.
Sure.
Dave Martucci is with us. Dave is a vexillologist, of course. He's up in Washington, Maine, and he's also the editor of the New England Journal of Vexillology.
This is Jeff Foxworthy, and I'm a road dog just like you. Keep those big wheels rolling with the best trucking radio on radio.
Before Ralph May joined Oakley, he did his homework.
I've got a lot of friends that I know that have got their trucks leased to Oakley, and they always had really great stuff to say about Oakley. I never heard no negative anything concerning Oakley about the way they treated their owner-operators.
We asked Ralph how he was doing with Oakley.
I didn't know I could make this kind of money. I own my own truck. It's my first truck. So when I leased on with Oakley, I didn't realize I could actually do this good with my own truck. And it's all due to the way Oakley takes care of us.
Oakley Trucking, America's dry bulk hauler. 888-945-1531. Here's ProTrack inventor Mike Beckett from MD Alignment.
Wear on the outside right front tire only. Combining toe in with a right pull is normally the cause for this. With toe in, the left steer tire is aimed to the right with the pull, while the right front tire is aimed left and is being scrubbed to the right wearing the outside edge.
Shops across America have the ProTrack system, and it's like having Mike align your truck. Go to davenemo.com and click on MD Alignment for locations, or call 800-617-5592.
We're road dogs, just like you. We spend our lives on the road, and our life is a highway.
Life is a highway. I want to ride it all night long.
You're jamming gears with the best trucking radio on radio, baby.
You know what I'm talking about. Turn it up and rip the knob off.
Dave Nemo with you. And don't forget our Washington Trucking Week coming up at the bottom of the hour with Rod Novziger, the Director of Governmental Affairs at OOIDA. A lot to talk about there. Dave Martucci is with us right now. And Dave, I'm actually looking at your official United States flags page on your website. Uh-huh. A lot of different designs here. You've got flags that in the canton, you've got flags where the stars make up a star. You've got a flag here called the sea flag where you've got one star in the middle and then a oval of stars, almost like going around a racetrack. All kinds of different designs. But I guess the flag that we're going to zero in now is called the Fort McHenry flag. And that's when Vermont and Kentucky joined the Union. So now we have 15 stars, but we also have 15 stripes.
That's right. In 1795, the Congress looked at the flag again and had a very difficult time debating what to do to represent new states. And in the end, they just said, well, we'll add a star and a stripe for everybody. That didn't work out because as new states came in, there would eventually be way too many stripes. So they would, in 1818, went back to the 13 stripes but kept adding stars, which is one of the ways that our flag is unique, that we've amended it so many times by adding new stars.
Exactly. One of the other things, too, that is interesting, if you look at some of the earlier flags, the stars themselves are five-pointed, but they don't line up in any particular direction. In other words, if you think of a star as a man, you'd have the two legs on the ground, the two
right.
arms, and then the head at the top. That's the way we see our flag now. They're all neatly lined up and precise and crisp. Flags, well, the Fort McHenry flag and some of the flags before that, the stars were kind of skewed around in different, almost purposely to be in all kinds of different directions.
That's right. If you remember the flag resolution, the stars were supposed to represent a new constellation. And a lot of people early on took that to heart, and they did a lot of different things with the stars to give them some variation, which is what you would expect to see in the sky if you were looking at a constellation. Stars of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, even 3 and 4 points were not uncommon. And their arrangement was, you know, left up to the imagination of the flag maker. And since almost every flag in those days was made by some seamstress who probably had no picture in front of them, they could use their imagination to put them together any way they wanted.
That's pretty interesting. And it's probably shouldn't be surprising that it wasn't until 1912 that we had an official design for the flag, because if you look at the history of the Star Spangled Banner, which was written by Francis Scott Key as a poem back in the War of 1812, the national anthem didn't become official until sometime in the 1930s. So we take
That's
a long
right.
time to officialize right. things in this country, and I think that's part and parcel of who we are and what we stand for.
That's right. Prior to the adoption of the national anthem, there were a lot of songs that could be played that represented us that would be considered a national anthem. And then nobody wanted to get too specific till it was way after the point where those people had died off. But as far as the Star Spangled Banner goes, it's a very interesting flag. It's only one variation of a number of different 15-star, 15-stripe flags that existed at that time. Again, there was no uniformity of design, but it's a very large flag, and it was put together by a woman and her daughter in Baltimore, Mary Pickersgill, and her daughter, and she was actually the daughter of a Revolutionary War era seamstress who may have also been one of the people, Rebecca Young, who may have made one of the first 13-star, 13-stripe flags. In fact, that's the tradition of their family, although it's not well known. So they had a long flag history, and that flag was actually, believe it or not, it was so big they couldn't make it in their own home where they normally made flags. They had to borrow the use of a local brewery so they had enough room to sew the flag up.
Wow, that's amazing. And the idea was that flag would be seen from a far distance by the ships.
Yeah, there were actually two flags that were made for Fort McHenry. One was half the size of the one we know today, which I don't remember the exact dimensions, but I believe it's over 40 feet long originally.
Wow.
And the other one was half that size, and it's probably more likely that Key saw the smaller flag when he actually started writing the Star Spangled Banner, but the next morning when it was clear the British attack had failed, the fort, there are several independent accounts of the fort hauling down its flag and the British briefly thinking for a moment something had gone right and then hoisting this gigantic flag sort of to say, hey, no way.
Absolutely. Well, if the Star-Spangled Banner is part and parcel of our flag history or our vexillological history, how you like that, Dave?
That's right.
The Pledge of Allegiance certainly plays into the history of the flag as well. On the other hand, going back to the early 1890s, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. The pledge was put together by, I think it was the editor of a children's magazine, and it was an idea that he promoted and eventually, many years later, was adopted into the flag code as something you could do if you chose to. But it's not mandatory. There's no penalty if you don't do the pledge, and that's in keeping with our flag traditions. There's very little about our flag that's mandatory. Most of the provisions of the flag code are recommendations. They're not law. There's no penalty if you do something wrong. There's no flag police. Many of the other large countries around the world have actual penalties if you do something wrong, and particularly some of the countries like China and the former Soviet Union had severe penalties if you did something wrong with the flag. But we don't do that here. We don't like it, perhaps, but we're not going to, you know, imprison people or even execute them if they do something wrong with the flag.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, we do have a flag code, but it
right.
doesn't have the weight of law.
Right. There's no penalty if you do something wrong. But it is a good code, and it gives very logical, common sense respect for the flag. If you're wondering how to do something, you can't go wrong if you follow the flag code.
Is the flag code a living document, Dave, or is it amended or added onto? And who wrote the flag code, and who's in charge of it?
Well, the flag code was originally proposed by the American Legion. It's actually kind of funny in a way because in the 19th century, particularly in the military, it was not uncommon for words to be added to flags. In fact, during the Civil War, the name of the regiment and the battles they were in were always painted on the flag. And by the 1920s, however, a new phenomenon had come up in which people were putting advertising on the flag. They were advertising hams and tires and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And the veterans didn't like that. And so they got together in the early 20s and started thinking up recommendations for how you should treat the flag. And it really came out of that opposition to putting advertising on the flag. And eventually Congress, I think it was 1942 or 43, I can't remember exactly, adopted the flag code. And it's been amended a number of times since then. Most recently, about 25 years ago, they increased the list of places where it's authorized to fly the flag day and night. But there are some other changes that will probably happen. For example, right now the flag code says the proper way to dispose of a worn-out flag is by burning. But with the advent of synthetic fibers, that's actually not a very good idea. In fact, a lot of the veterans' posts today, instead of burning flags, they actually hold burial ceremonies because nylon and rayon and other synthetic materials now very widely used in flags are, hazardous material if they're burned.
Understood.
Yeah.
Understood.
So it is an evolving thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, as situations change, you know, it's one of those things that we really ought to be changing as we go along.
Yeah, exactly. And it speaks to the living presence of what we're all about.
That's right.
Well, Dave, it's been a fascinating discussion. I'm thank you for allowing us to link your page to ours. I really enjoyed surfing through your webpage. A lot of stuff on there, a lot of great pictures, and I really appreciate you being with us on the program this morning.
Well, thanks a lot, Dave. I really appreciate it. And anytime you want to talk flags, please give me a call.
You know what? We're going to do that, believe it or not. you're on the hook now.
All right.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks a lot.
And
take
happy
care.
Flag Day on Sunday.
Same to you.
Dave Martucci, everybody. And Dave's website, if you want to go now, is vexman.net. A lot of great information there, and you'll really like his Good Flag, Bad Flag pages.